Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian of the Society Library, and you're sitting this afternoon in our beautiful members' room, which is a lovely old reading room that we've been using for over 70 years in this location of the Society Library. For those of you who are guests from Abrams House, this library, believe it or not, is 254 years old. We started back in 1754, and it's older than an awful lot of us in this room. The Society Library was founded in 1754, and it's back when the word society actually really didn't mean anything about society or income or money. It was a meaning of the word which meant to help other people and to build a collection of books and improve society. I would like to now introduce Carrie Silberman, the head of the Children's Library, and she's going to introduce our wonderful guest today.
Our special guest this evening, author Patricia Riley Gift, has spent her entire life surrounded by books. I would venture to guess that many of you have a lot in common with her. First, Pat considers herself a bookworm. Raise your hand if you consider yourself a bookworm. Well, then you're just like Pat. Please raise your hand if you like to read either with your parents, with your children, or your grandchildren. Anybody here like to do so? Well, then you're just like Pat. Okay, raise your hand if you've ever had somebody grab a book out of your hand to get your attention. Anybody hear that ever happen to? Well, you're just like Pat. And finally, raise your hand if you've ever read in the bathtub. Anybody here ever read in the bathtub? Well, then you are just like Pat. Patricia Riley Gift has written more than 65 books for children and has been honored with 2 Newbery Honor Awards by the American Library Association, as well as the prestigious Boston Globe Hornbook Award. I'm very honored to introduce Patricia Riley Gift.
Thank you. About that bathtub business, I must tell you that I would read a library book in the bathtub and fall asleep. And so I can't tell you how many times my husband had to go back to the library and pay for the library book. So I'm lucky I'm still married. Isn't that true? Anyway, one of the best parts about being a writer are the questions I'm asked. For example, did you come in a limo? No. Do you live in a mansion? No. Did you ever meet Hannah Montana? Sorry, I haven't. But one of my favorite questions is from a boy who sat right in the front row, and the whole time I was talking, he was looking at me so intently. I know he was paying so much attention to me. He looked up at my head, then he looked down at my feet, and when I said, are there any questions, he raised his hand quickly and he said, could I ask you? And I said, yes. Why are you wearing one blue shoe and one brown shoe? And another question from a boy in front of a library, frowning a little bit, and he said, how many books do you think you'll write before? He stops and takes a breath. Then he gets it out in a rush. How many books do you think you'll be able to write before you die? I take a breath, too, thinking about it. It's a terrible thought. But I say, 100. 100 books, he said. How long does it take you to write each book? So I said, at least a year. And before he has time to add it all up, I tell him, that gives me another 100 years of life, doesn't it? But can you guess the question that I'm asked most often is, where do I get my ideas? And there are a couple of answers to that. First, from my own life, would it surprise you to know that I'm the hero in some of my books? I wrote a book once. It's called Have You Seen Hyacinth McCaw? The hero is Abby Jones. I'm the hero. And she wants to solve this mystery. There's also a detective in it because my husband was a detective. And then there is the criminal. Her name is Tootsie Tanner. She has wild black hair. She has huge blue eyes. Abby knows she's trouble. And in real life, do you know who it is? My mother-in-law. So, mostly I get my ideas. I love my mother-in-law, by the way. She would laugh over this, too. I get my ideas, as I said, from my own life. And I'm going to tell you first about growing up during the war. The war means a long time ago, the Second World War. And the most terrible part of the war for me was no candy. It was all going overseas to the soldiers and the sailors and the Marines. And so you'd walk from one block to the next, and maybe you'd find a Hershey bar in one store or a roll of Necco wafers in another store. And one day, my best friend Millicent called me across the street. "Patty," she said, "my mother's gone to the store. You have to come up here and see what I found." Up the stairs I went, into the attic. Behind the chimney was a bag of more candy than I had ever seen before in my life. "What's this?" I said. She said, "My mother is saving all this candy. She's going all over to buy candy, and she's going to send it overseas to my brother Eddie." She said, "That'll be a melted mess in all this heat, and I'm not even going to get a sniff of it." I looked at that candy. My mouth was watering. I said, "If Eddie eats all this candy, he's going to get cavities." And she said, "That's true." I said, "We could help him out a little bit here." And she said, "Yes, I was thinking that. We'll take one candy bar, we'll throw the paper back in the corner in the dark where nobody will see it, and we'll split the candy bar in half." "Great," I said. "But do you know how long it takes to eat a half a candy bar when you're dying for candy? Maybe like a half a second?" "And so here's all this candy left." And Millicent said, "Well, maybe we should each have a candy bar. And we'll throw the paper behind the corner there, and nobody will ever know. We'll just fluff up the bag." And so that's what we did for about a half an hour. And so here it is in Lily's Crossing. I became Lily. My best friend Millicent became a Margaret. And here she is showing Lily. Margaret reached for a paper bag. Look, she held it out. Inside were about 14 candy bars, Hershey's, Walnuttos, Sugar Daddy, lollipops, even a couple of rolls of assorted Lifesavers. Lily's eyes widened. Not counting the dusty case in Mrs. Tannenbaum's stationery store, she'd never seen so much candy in her whole life. She reached out to run her fingers over a roll of Necco wafers. Her mouth was watering. She could see four yellow ones in a row, her favorite kind. "Maybe we could take one thing," Margaret said, "just one. My mother is saving all this for my brother Eddie in the Army. Now that he's a soldier fighting for his country, he gets everything, and I don't even get a sniff of it." And so that's what they did. And they sat there for a half an hour. And then suddenly, Margaret was peeling the paper back off the rest of another candy bar. And her eyes widened. "Holy mackerel," Margaret said. "Here comes my mother." Lily looked over her shoulder. Mrs. Dillon was coming up the attic stairs. Lily could see the top of her head first, and then her shoulders. They scooped the candy back into the bag, Lily trying to swallow the rest of the butterscotch, which was stuck to her back teeth. And then Mrs. Dillon was right there, standing in front of them, looking as if she would burst into tears. "How could you?" she said to Margaret. "I walked for blocks for that candy, one store after another. This one didn't have peppermints, the other didn't have Hershey's. There's a war on, no candy." Mrs. Dillon looked out the window. "My poor Eddie," she said. Lily edged her way to the stairs, feeling guilty, feeling horrible. "I think I'd better go home now," she said, using her best manners. "It was very nice of you to have me over." She rushed down the stairs, and as she let herself out the door, she could hear Mrs. Dillon. "That Lily Mollahan is trouble," she was saying. "And you're not one bit better, Margaret." Lily stopped to see if Margaret was going to say anything, but she couldn't hear a thing. She dug the last of the butterscotch off her back teeth and headed for Graham's. The summer certainly wasn't starting off very well. Not very well at all. And so, there you have the criminal. I promised myself when I crossed the street, because Mrs. Dillon was behind me crying, that I would never steal a candy bar for the rest of my life. And I didn't. Luckily, I married a man who has been putting candy bars in my night table for the last 49 years. And the dentist loves it. He thinks it's a great idea. And so, sometimes I get my ideas from my own self, and then sometimes I write about people I know. One of the best parts of being a writer is to go to the restaurant. My husband hates it because I'm always leaning into the next table trying to listen to the conversation, because if you're going to be a writer, you have to be a spy. And sometimes you hear very good things about what's going on in other people's lives, and that's what I do. Okay, so now, my favorite author, I'm not going to tell you who he is just yet, but he told me two things. In fact, he told me a lot more than two things, but the two things that I'm thinking about is, he said, first, we like to write about things we want to know about, and second, we write about people we'd like to have as friends. And I think that's a very true statement. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit this afternoon about my great-grandmother, because I wrote a book about her. I always wanted to know about her. Here is her story, which I've put in this book. I'm going to tell you a little bit, and then I'm going to read you a little bit. Her name was Dina, and she lived in Heidelberg, and her mother and father were tailors, and they did a lot of sewing. Now, Dina was a wonderful seamstress herself, but she despised sewing. She hated sewing. And one day came a letter from the uncle who had gone to Brooklyn, and in the letter he said, "Dina, if you come to Brooklyn, you will be rich. People have diamonds in the street that you can pick up, and you will never have to sew again." That's all 16-year-old Dina needed to hear, because that's what she wanted so much. And at last, she was able to talk her mother into sending her on that terrible trip in 1870 to Brooklyn, New York, America. When she got to Brooklyn, the uncle was waiting for her, and he took her heavy wooden case with her clothes and her things, and they walked through the streets of Brooklyn. She didn't think Brooklyn looked as good as she thought it would look, because it was pretty dirty looking, so dirty that she couldn't even see the diamonds that must be there in front of her on the street. They walked, and at last they came to a very tall building, and she said, "Well, this is more like it. This is one big building for our family." Then to find out that the part for their family was on the fifth floor, and they had to walk all the way up to the fifth floor where the aunt was waiting. They opened the door. There was a little hallway. At the end of the hallway was a sewing machine, and underneath the rug had been worn bare. And in that moment, she knew that he had lied to her. There were no diamonds, and she would have to sew for the rest of her life, and she could never go home again. So that's a little bit about Dina. After she was here about a year, she met Johann Schaefer, who was going to be her husband. In fact, I'm wearing the ring. See that gold ring there, the little round one? That's the ring he gave Dina in 1872, the day they were married. So, there was an epidemic, and what would happen in those days, if you had smallpox, the Board of Health would come in a wagon with two horses. They'd clop down the street. They'd go from apartment to apartment, and if you had smallpox, you were taken to the hospital where you died. There was nothing they could do for you, and so that was a scary thing. In fact, Dina had seen two of the men with their horse and wagon in the park a few days before. Now, here she is in the apartment with Barbara and the little baby Maria, and both of them have diphtheria. And here's Dina. I saw the health department wagon in front of our place, the two men with their dark beards knocking on someone's door, just as Johann had said. And so I've got the wrong place. How could that be? I'm going to have to find it. Here we are. I heard the cart, the horses clapping, the wheels grinding. I bent to look out the window. The cart stopped at the first house, leaving a trail in the mud behind it. Still barefoot, I ran into Barbara's bedroom. Listen to me, Barbara, stand up. Barbara's eyes stayed closed. Dina, she whispered, hide the baby. I slid my hands under Barbara's back. How hot she was. I lifted her slowly until she was sitting, leaning against the pillow. Since I had thrown myself on the couch the night before, a mark had appeared on her forehead. We'll trick them, Barbara. We'll try. I reached for the brush and ran it through her hair. How could I ever trick them? I combed Barbara's hair into loops over her forehead and felt a quick rush of tears as I suddenly remembered my sister in Germany. It wasn't possible to hide the mark completely, but it was the best I could do. From the window, I could see the wagon moving again. I had time to wonder if someone had been taken from the first house as I slid Barbara's feet and legs from under the blanket. Marks there, too, on her ankle, but her skirt would hide them. I rubbed her legs, wondering if I would come down with the pox. A stab of fear went through me as I thought about the men coming, pulling me out of my bed, dragging me down the stairs and into the cart on a stretcher, never to come back from the hospital. I dressed Barbara. She leaned against me, hide the baby. I looked toward the crib. Maria's still awake. She'd be asleep in a moment, and even if I could hide her, what about the crib? What about the list the men might have telling who was in the house? I walked Barbara into the kitchen, holding her tightly so she wouldn't fall. The downstairs door was opening now. Would they start at the apartment on the ground floor, or would they come up the stairs and begin at the top? I could hear the rough feet on the steps below, coming higher. We were next, then. I looked down at my feet, remembering that my shoes were by the sofa. I leaned Barbara against the sink. Can you hold on? Hide the baby. I curled her hands over the wooden rim of the sink. Don't talk. Don't turn your head. Just hold on. I took a step away from her, hesitating. I wondered if she could do it. Hide the baby, she said. But now the noise of the heavy footsteps turned up the last stairway. I pulled on my shoes, buttoning the bottom two buttons, no time for stockings, and then went into Maria. I pulled off the old blanket and kicked it under Barbara's bed with my foot, then covered the baby with a clean pink blanket. Would the men be rough to it with her? I felt fear in my mouth and my throat, my tongue so dry I could hardly answer as the men pounded on the door. Coming, I am coming, sir. But I knew they couldn't hear my whisper. I walked down the hall and opened the door. They came inside, those big men with the dark beards, so big they seemed to take up the whole room. At the sink, Barbara's head was lowered, her hair, a veil across the side of her head, of her face. Her hands were slipping off the sink, and I took a step toward her, leaning against her for just a moment. One of them motioned to her with his thumb. No English she speaks, I said. Greenhorn. They both laughed. I knew it was because of my own English. But that was all right, as long as they left her alone and didn't make her turn toward them. Is there a sickness in the house? One of them asked. I betrayed Maria with a quick look down the hall. They brushed past me, and I followed them, standing in the doorway as they looked down at her. The baby in the park the other day who waved at herself, such a pity. Please, I grabbed his arm, almost forgetting I was afraid. I held tight. We will take care, her mother and I. The apartment is, what was that word? Clean, is so clean. The baby is clean. He turned to me and shook his head. We have to. I raced on. She will die in the hospital. The man raised his hand and uncurled my fingers from his sleeve. She has the pox. I'm so sorry. A voice came from the kitchen. Barbara. What is she saying? The man asked. I didn't bother to answer. Please, I was wringing my hands. We will not move out of this house. We'll stay in here with her until she's better, or... I was silent then. But in the end, I think it was not I who saved Maria. She woke suddenly and looked up at the man and smiled. her small, shy smile, the most beautiful smile. I could feel it myself, the sweetness even through the redness and the oozing blisters on her face. She raised one little hand in its white cloth, almost as if she'd give them a backward wave. Then her hand fell, and she closed her eyes. I went to the crib and put my head down on the crib rail, hearing the soft sound one of the men made in back of his throat. "Like my daughter," he said gruffly. "No one sick here. A clean house. Good, careful people." They tramped down the hall again through the kitchen, not even noticing Barbara as her hand slid away from the sink. They had just closed the door behind themselves when she collapsed on the floor in front of me. That's a mostly true story. My great-grandfather knew that his wife, Dina, who becomes Barbara here, and his little baby, Maria, both had the pox, and he was desperate to think of what he could do to save them. So he stayed up all night, and he washed down the walls of the apartment, and he cleaned the entire apartment. And at the last minute, when the cart came along, he dressed my great-grandmother in her clothes, and he told her to hold on to the rim of the sink with her hair down in front of her and not to turn her head, because had she turned her head, they would have seen the marks on her face. There was no hiding Maria, but when the men saw Maria, he had bandaged her hands, and he had a beautiful little blanket. He, too, was a tailor. And so he talked them into leaving Maria there. And that's the story that my grandmother and my mother told me about my great-grandmother. And the last part of the story was that as soon as the men closed the door, my great-grandmother collapsed on the floor. She couldn't hold on anymore, and he carried her into bed. And he saved them both, and my grandmother would say, "And Maria, who had the marks of the pox on her face, the scars, and yet two men were in love with Maria all her life." And so that's the way that story was finished. And a part of myself, you know, I went to Heidelberg with my husband and my mother, and my mother was standing in front of the house where Dina had come from, and she was crying, telling me that all her life Dina wanted to go home to Germany, and never could, of course. She never went home. She never saw her mother again. And we walked down just to the corner of the street where my great-grandmother's house was, and there was a bookstore. And in the window was my first book in German. And my mother said, "So you came home for her." So that's the story about A House of Tailors. And so, you see, we write about the people we want to write about, and that we love, that we want to know, and we also want to know more about. And so that's what that story is like. Now, I have talked so long. Is there anybody in between who has a question for me? Yes, Joe.
Did you have any relatives who were in World War II?
Did I have any relatives who were in World War II? Yes, I had an uncle who flew B-24 bombers in World War II, and when you read Willow Run, you'll read about the factory that built those bombers. It was a mile-long factory, and they built the B-24 bombers there, and because my uncle had a movie about it that they had taken, I was able to learn a little bit more about it. Yes? How did I feel about the story about Hollis Woods? All right, now, I'll tell you. Every time I answer a question, it takes forever, so I'm sorry about that, but that's what a storyteller does. This is pictures of Hollis Woods. So this story is a little bit sad in the beginning, but not very. My mother was 90 years old, and she was getting ready to die. But she was 90 years old. She had a long life. But she was still my mom, and she held my hand, and she said, "I think I'll never go home again." She was in the hospital, and I wanted to know where she wanted to go home. She was confused, and I didn't know, was it the house where I had grown up? Was it the house where she had grown up? And then I said to myself, it would be the summer house that we had on the Delaware River, because she loved that house. And I wanted to kidnap her. I wanted to pick up my elegant mother, who always had her earrings on before breakfast. I wanted to take her up to the place that she loved. And of course, I couldn't do that. So a very nice author named Mem Fox says, we write to give ourselves a present, something we can't have. So I decided I would write Pictures of Hollis Woods, in which the hero, I'm the hero, would kidnap an old lady and take her up to that house so that my mother could have that house again. And so I said to myself, I'm going to write a book that even if my mother didn't see my name, she would know it was written for her. And so Hollis Woods is very close to where we grew up in Hollis. And all the names in this book have to do with my mother. Beatrice was her best friend growing up. She's Josie Kale. That's the name of her favorite aunt. Even Henry, the irritable cat, was my mother's first cousin. So everybody got in there, and so that's my favorite book. But I have to tell you my favorite two questions, if you can pretend a little bit. You know what a picture book is? Do you know those big books that you first begin to read and they have a million colored pictures inside? So I was speaking to a group of children, kindergartners in Oregon. And then I said, do you have any questions? And two children raised their hands. The first one said, how do you get these letters so nice and even? Oh, I said, I don't do that. I write on a computer, and then a company does the printing. Oh, she said, and sat down. The next one said, how do you have time to take a crayon and color in all the pictures in all the books? I said, oh, I have to tell you, I don't even draw the pictures. An illustrator draws the pictures. She sat down and she leans over and she says to the girl next to her, she doesn't do the words and she doesn't do the pictures. I don't think she does anything. I don't even know why she's here. Do you have another question? Yes. How does it feel to write the kids to the Polk Street School? Well, this is another long answer. Can I answer in a long way? I was in a school in New Jersey, very much like this, with a whole bunch of kids. And when I went to walk out the door, a boy came up to me and he yanked on my arm hard. Hey, write a book about me, he said. And I said, hey, what's your name? He said, well, my name is Richard, but don't call me Richard, call me Beast. That's what my teacher calls me. And so I went home thinking about writing a book about a boy named Beast. Now, anyone can write a book, but you have to have one thing. Do you all have a living room floor or a bedroom floor? Then you certainly can write a book. Now, picture me that day. I stretched out on the living room floor. My cat Fiddle came jumping down the stairs and threw himself around my neck like a black and white fur collar. And I began to think about the most important part of my book. And the most important part of your book is the person. So I make a person in my mind. I make it a very skinny person because I'm always on a diet, which never really works. But that's what I was thinking of down on the floor, that boy named Beast. And I called my daughter in from the kitchen and I said, if I'm going to have a boy, I need a girl in here too, right? So my daughter Alice came in and she said she'd be the star. She danced around me in her red dirty sneakers and a party dress, which she wore every 2 minutes when she could. Next morning, I went upstairs to my desk with two bowls of cereal, one for Fiddle and one for me. And we eat as fast as we can because Fiddle thinks I have a special human cereal and he wants to get into that cereal. And because Fiddle is a very dirty cat who spends his time in the woods playing around with all kinds of snakes and things, so I have to eat my cereal very quickly. So while we're doing that, I'm thinking about the second part of my book, And what I do is I take the person by the hair of his imaginary head, and I drop him into a place I know. I have only one more thing to do. I have to give my person a problem, and then I'm ready to write. So first I take a person, I put him in a place, and I give him a problem. And so here we are with a couple of secrets I might reveal. The 9 o'clock bell rang. Richard Best pounded down the hall of the Polk Street School and burst into room 113. Miss Rooney was telling everyone where to sit. She smiled at Richard and pointed. "Sit right there behind Matthew Jackson," she said. Richard slid into the seat behind Matthew. Matthew had stick-out ears and a wet-the-bed smell. It was September, the first day of school. Everything was just the same, same old classroom painted up a little. The same old Miss Rooney with her puffy brown hair and a lot of orange lip stuff. There was something different, though. The rest of the kids. Last year, they were babies in Mrs. White's room. And now they were in Miss Rooney's room, and so was he, again, a left back. The kids probably thought he was huge, gigantic. He slid down in his seat and pulled his head into his neck a little. A girl sat across from him. She was wearing a pink party dress and dirty red sneakers. Her legs looked like popsicle sticks. The girl looked over at him and smiled. Maybe she thought he was the one with the wet smell. He frowned at her, then he pulled in his breath. Sniffing loudly, he stuck the eraser end of his new pencil up his nose. The pencil swung back and forth gently. The girl looked as if she was going to throw up. "Good," Miss Rooney began to call the roll. "Emily Arrow," she said. "Here," said the girl in the party dress and the red sneakers. Richard tore a piece of paper out of his new notebook. He started to draw a picture of a ship and lots of sharks. Miss Rooney said some more names. "Richard Best," she said. "Beast," said Richard. Miss Rooney looked up. She shook her head. Matthew turned around and grinned at Richard. His teeth were big and curled on the ends. Richard ran his tongue over his own teeth, little bitty, stumpy things. He pressed on them hard to see if they'd wiggle. They didn't. He was probably the only kid his age in the whole world who still had baby top teeth. He closed his mouth and clamped his teeth together. He'd have to talk with his mouth almost closed so no one would notice. He tried to practice under his breath. "I am from outer space," he said, without moving his lips. So, that's the beginning. And you could see, first I took a person, I put him in a place, I gave him a problem. I made him move, that's the action. I made him talk, the dialogue. I made him worry about the problem. And let me tell you, the problem is going to get worse and worse, but in the end, Richard will solve the problem. So there are some secrets in there. Who do you think Miss Rooney might have been in real life? Yes, Joe. I was Miss Rooney. That's absolutely true. And you know, Beast is the boy I met in New Jersey, and Emily Arrow is my daughter. But now I have one secret which I will reveal to you. But if you ever come to Connecticut, I do not want to hear about this, all right? How about Matthew with the stick-out ears? Who could he be in real life? Yes. My husband has beautiful ears. I'll introduce him. That's why I married him. No, the truth is, I have the stick-out ears. You see, they're all hidden in my hair. First date I had with my husband, the wind was blowing. He looked in my ears and had the nerve to say, "Boy, you have big ears, and they're skinny, too." Yeah, he did. He's laughing. He thinks that's funny. I married him anyway, and you know, when my three children were born, each one, the first thing I said is, "Never mind, boy or girl, just let me look at the ears. Let them be good ears like my husband's." And then when they were going to get married, I said, "Yes, bring your future spouse home and let me check the ears out and make sure." And thank goodness they were all right. So now, what else can I tell you? Is there something else or shall I go on? No questions. Okay. I'll tell you two more questions that I loved, and that was in a fourth grade classroom. And I said, "Are there any questions?" And everybody's eyes slid away from me. Nobody could think of a question. And the teacher was standing on the side, and she was so irritated. And she was looking at the children as if to say, "Ask her something, ask her anything." So two hands shot up, and the first one said, "All right, how old are you?" And the second one said, "Yeah, and how much money do you make anyway?" So I couldn't get out of that. That was very hard. Now, where do I get my ideas? I was a reading teacher. You can tell I was a teacher if you read the Polk Street school books. But one of the things that I wanted to write about was what happens to a person who can't read. And because I was a reading teacher, I know how terrible that is not to be able to read. And one day my mother said to me, "Everybody has something. You just have to look for what that something is." And so I wanted to write a book about this boy who couldn't read, and I wanted to give him something. Here he is. He's thinking about the room, the resource room. He knew it so well. And Mrs. Waring, the resource teacher, the smell of her lunch coffee strong as she spoke, her voice with a twang. "Sam," she called him. Her smile was great, even though her teeth were a little crooked. When she showed him a book with about four words on each page, words he couldn't read. "What does all that look like to you?" she said. He shrugged. How could he say that the lines moved like black spiders, stretching their legs and waving their feelers across the page? She was sorry. He could see that. "Look," she pointed out the window. "What do you see?" "Trees, two of them." "Yes, you see the branches, the leaves, and that tells you they're not houses or clouds. You don't even have to think about it. Trees." He'd felt something begin in his chest, because he couldn't imagine that happening when he read. "That's the way it is with words," she said. "After a while, the circles and lines will mean something. They'll jump out at you. So that trees are trees and not clouds." The bell had rung then and he had escaped. The thing in his chest was growing, was going to explode. He held it in while they gathered up their books in the classroom, held it in on the bus, almost bursting with it, just waiting till he reached his grandfather Mac in the workshop. Mac had sat with him on the bench at the side wall as it finally burst out into the loud sound of his crying. Mac's arm had gone around him, and he'd hardly been able to get the words out, only spiders on the page that will never look like anything but spiders. He'd buried his head into Mac's shirt, smelling furniture wax and pine, and Mac had cleared his throat. "You have a gift, Sam," he said, "a gift like mine." He'd burrowed deeper into Mac's shirt, listening. "You don't know it yet," Mac said, "but it's the wood. It talks to us." "What did that have to do with anything?" "Already you feel the wood under your fingers. I've seen you." That was true. Sam would run his fingers over the wood, imagining where it had come from. Pine from the forests here in New York State, or mahogany from the jungles far away. He knew what the woods were good for, what they could be made into. "You read the wood," Mac said, "and that's something almost no one else can do." Mac had turned up Sam's chin with those broad fingers. "You'll learn to read, Sam. It may take longer than most. It may never be your strong point, but you have this." Mac's hand swept over the workroom, wood stacked, waiting to become chairs or tables, tools gleaming, and in a voice Sam strained to hear, "You have me, Sam, me and Anji and Anima, and we all love you more than anything." And when I wrote that, I thought about my dad down in his workroom in the basement, running his hands over the wood, because when my father had time off, when he wasn't working, he would go down there and he would build wonderful things for us, a playpen for my doll, a cradle, things for my mother. And so there was my father and my mother over my shoulder saying, "Everybody has something. And so all you have to do is look for it." So before I finish now, is there something you would like to ask me? Have I answered all your questions? Yes. Did you? Oh, no, I thought I saw your hands right. All right, now it's my turn. Oh, yes. No, I don't still teach reading. I'm a pretty old lady now. And so, So that I tell the truth sometimes. Most of the time I tell the truth. I taught reading for 20 years, and I'll tell you one little funny story about it. I was speaking in Texas a while back, and I was talking about my desperados. I taught tough kids. And so I explained that two of my kids were serving life sentences for murder. And after I finished speaking and I went out in the hall, a woman came up and put her hands on my arms and she said, I hope you don't feel guilty. And I said, about what? And she said, about your two sons who were serving life sentences. But yes, I loved teaching. I taught in a PS 136 in Queens, and then I taught in Elmont, which is very close to the Belmont racetrack. And 2 days ago, I finished the second draft of a book that is set in the Belmont racetrack area. Was I writing when I was a teacher? Well, I have to tell you, long answers, right? One day I woke up teaching, and the snow was coming down outside. Now, if you are a reading teacher, you know that you are expendable. So when you get to school and half the staff is absent, what are they going to do with the reading teacher? They're going to put her from one room to the other. Instead of teaching reading, she's going to have to be the sub for the morning. And so I was grumbling, and I said to my husband, if I wrote a book, I wouldn't have to go to school today. And he said, he was a detective, New York City detective. He was off for the day. I said, if I wrote a book, I could stay in my nightgown and bathrobe all day long and eat candy corn, and I wouldn't even have to get dressed on a day like this. And he said, And I walked into the bathroom, started to wash my face, and one gray hair had appeared right here. And I said to myself, if I don't write soon, it's going to be too late. But I went to school, and I forgot about the whole thing. And that afternoon, when I came home, my husband was in the kitchen hammering. Where before we had two skinny closets with a wall in between, he had bashed down that wall. Now we had one fat closet, and he had put up a shelf with my typewriter. In those days, we didn't have computers. And I said to him, what are you doing? And he said, well, if you're going to write a book, you have to have a place to write. So I had a choice. I could put all the canned goods back in the closet or put myself in the closet, and you know what I did. But I didn't have a clue about how I was going to write. And I did find out that I could take my newspaper into the closet with my coffee while they were doing the dishes and then sneak out afterward. My children were outside. They were not fooled. They would say to my husband, she's not writing a book. She's reading her newspaper. And when she was just teaching, we never had socks that matched under our boots, so we had to wear the boots all day. And now that she says she's writing, we don't even have clean socks to wear. We go barefoot. Of course, that was all a big lie, you understand. But my husband said, she is going to write a wonderful book. We're going to be famous. We'll buy socks by the barrelful. We'll put new ones on every morning and throw them out at night. I had not written one word. So I ran off to the library, and I took 10 children's books off the shelf, and I opened each one to the first page, and I didn't read the books. I had no time. I just could read the first page. I just had to find out how to begin. I wasn't even thinking about getting to the middle, and so this is what I found out. First, you take a person, put him in a place, give him a problem, and now, remember I said my favorite author has given me little things? And one of these things that this favorite author said to me was, you should have dialogue on the first page. Children like dialogue. And so from then on, all these books that I have written have been have dialogue because my absolutely favorite author, the best, told me. And I will tell you that he is here this afternoon. And his name is Richard Peck, and he's sitting back next to my teddy bear husband. And you turn around and you look and you say, you have seen the man who writes the most wonderful books in this country. And that's all I have to say. Thank you. You were such a super audience. I loved talking to you. Bye now.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm you, though.